all wondered from time to time if we're losing our minds. We forget things if we don't write them down on a to-do list. We remember faces but not names of the people we've met. We have, some of us, seemingly irrational fears and or beliefs. What are we thinking? What are our brains doing? We will find out this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk with a guest who is a neuroscientist, and he is the author of the book, Idiot Brain, about why our amazing and awesome brains seemingly fail us from time to time. And we'll welcome your questions and maybe some of your examples about how your brain is an idiot sometimes. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. Very happy to have with us Dean Burnett, a neuroscientist and lecturer for Cardiff University in the Center for Medical Education. He also writes for The Guardian, a regular section called Brain Flapping, and he is the author of the book, Idiot Brain, What Your Head is Really Up To. Hello, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Joy.
So why did you decide on this title, Idiot Brain?
It wasn't actually me. It was the publishers and their sort of marketing people. I wanted to call it some various other things, like I have some very descriptive ways of referring to the brain, and I wanted to use one of those, but they said, you can't use those because no one else knows what you're talking about, which is always a problem. And they went with idiot brain because it's a very concise way of sort of summarizing everything that's in the book, like just the many ways in which your brain can be less powerful and less intelligent, less smart as you'd hope. But also, it's also a good way to find people who, I've been called a few times, who, if you think this is right, you must be an idiot too. And like that's, if you think that's good writing, then obviously I can discount your opinion. So it's a nice way to filter out who's right and who's wrong about things.
And I read that you also thought that we have a lot of information about the science of the brain and how awesome and smart our brains are, but maybe not enough on how our brains are, sometimes make mistakes.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the overall point of what I'm, basically my ethos, my if we call it ideology, for want of a better term, in that I'm obviously a neuroscientist, very big fan of the brain. I mean, it's my brain which is doing that as well, so I'm not sure how impartial I am, but it's also it's a very, very impressive organ. It's extremely powerful, extremely complicated. It's a lot of it, what it does, we don't know how it does it. It's so sophisticated and quite marvelous in many ways, but there's this sort of mystique around it, the whole idea that, it's sort of beyond our understanding and we can't, it's almost like you can't scratch the surface, you can't look into it, that's offensive or something, that's just, it's spoiling the magic. And as powerful as the brain is, it is still, at the end of the day, an organ, sort of part of the human body, and the rest of the human body has issues and flaws. I'm sure nobody would say their body is, people say my body is a temple, but I don't think anyone really means that. Every other part of the body has quirks and tics and eccentricities, and the brain's very much like that. And these things impact on everything we do, like every part of our daily life in many ways. So to sort of ignore these, I think, is unhelpful. So when things do, with your brain do go wrong, or backfires in some way, or does something incomprehensible, that's not you. Nothing wrong with you. That's just a quirk. That's just how the brain does things. So being aware of that is probably a bit more reassuring than thinking it's some sort of supercomputer that can't possibly go wrong.
So why is it that I know I want to go get that pencil and paper in the other room, and I walk into the other room, and then I wonder why I'm in that other room?
Yeah, it's obviously a very common phenomenon, the fact that you can, I think even Calvin Hobbes mentioned it once, you can remember a jingle from a commercial, like from your childhood, without any effort, but you can't remember 20 seconds ago what it was you wanted to do. Probably the main fact is that, like, most people know about long-term and short-term memory, but most people don't seem to realize that short-term memory is incredibly short-term, in that anything longer than like a minute, maybe 2 minutes, if you can still remember that, that's now a long-term memory. The short-term memory lasts like 30 seconds to a minute, or you know, slightly longer in some people. It's very, very brief. It's fleeting. And the short-term memory is where we sort of hold the things we're thinking about. I hesitate to use the computer analogy for brains, but if you think of the long-term memory as like the hard drive and the short-term as the processor, that would be sort of how it's sort of set up. But the short-term memory is a very small capacity. You can hold maybe like four things. I mean, it's really hard to define what a thing is, but four things any one go. So if you think to yourself, I need to get something from the other room, and you get up and head towards it, and then something happens, like if someone calls your name, or you just remember a song that you heard, or the radio's on, and something's mentioned. And then by the time you get to the room where you're going, it's gone, because you didn't have a chance to lay it down in long-term memory, and something pushed it out. And there you are in a separate room. And also another theory is that you know, the fact of changing rooms is something the brain sort of gets a bit caught out by, because you know, when you sat down in your lounge, you think, I need something from the kitchen. When you enter the kitchen, you're in a different room now, so the brain sort of resets a bit and thinks of a new scenario, and you lose what you had in the previous room. And it's a very weird, complex sort of system, but it's one that keeps affecting us in this sort of very constant and annoying way.
That's all we can. We can only store just a certain finite small number of things in our short-term memory. There's no way to expand that, darn brain.
Well, it has lots of sort of workarounds and sort of cheats. And that's why we say things, not numbers, not words. But if you like trying to remember a word list, so like there's a row of words, and you can normally remember four at any one time. But you can also remember like four sentences, and that would be sort of the brain groups things together like that, so it counts as a thing. But it's, you know, it normally gets around it because it's very quick to end things as a long-term memory. So if you're told someone's phone number, for example, like that's a sequence of numbers, all the numbers you already know, they're already in your long-term memory. It's the specific order. So if you rehearse it enough, so say it to yourself 10 times in a row, 12 times in a row, then you're far less likely to forget it next time because the brain's had enough time to form it into a long-term memory, which is actually has a physical basis in the cortex. It's a combination of synapses and things, so it has that time to make the memory, and that takes about a minute. So that's why some things less than a minute ago can be so fleeting.
Well, I found a silly Facebook meme that I posted as a promotion for this program, and it was paraphrasing here, something along the lines, I have learned two valuable life lessons. The first one I don't remember, and the second one is write everything down. So does writing help things down?
Yeah, it actually does, because the brain's dealing with so much stuff at any one time, or everything, even just sitting down, staring into space, that is still a lot of sensory information the brain has to process, and it only has a certain number of resources to do that. So anything you can do to help things become easy to remember, and then writing things down, it's not just, say if you have a message or a phone number, you're not just remembering the sound of the phone number, now you're actually committing it onto paper, so the act of writing it down means you have to involve your visual system, you have to involve your motor system to hold the pen and everything, and you have now a memory of writing as well, so sort of builds up more of a concrete memory in that respect, rather than just fleetingly hoping for the best when you're just told something.
In the book, you state that your memory is egotistical. What does that mean exactly?
Well, to clarify, everyone's is, not just mine.
Well, I just meant yours.
Well, it is. I can't deny that. But also, it's really good at it. It's a strange sort of. There's a lot of memory biases in that the human brain doesn't remember things like a computer does. That's one thing people seem to be kind of sort of hung up on, in that our memories are completely and utterly reliable. They are an accurate record of the thing we experienced. And that's not what happens. Like in a computer, it does. The information goes in, stays there until you need it, you bring it back later, it's the same. Whereas human memory is a lot more organic, a lot more flexible. So every time you remember something, so classic example being a fishing trip. When the fisherman says, I caught a fish this big, and holds their arms out way, way bigger than the fish actually was. And in that case, what's happening, they're retrieving a memory and they're exaggerating it to look better and to impress people. But the brain sort of updates the memory. It updates the story of doing that, and then it slowly but surely, the original memory is overlaid by the new one, which makes the story more impressive. But also the brain's very good at, it sort of seems charged with making us feel good about ourselves. Obviously, that's a good, you know, it's a good way to be, to make us feel like we are good people and we are competent and capable, because that, otherwise we get really nervous and scared of everything. So oftentimes our memories are slightly tweaked to make us feel better and more capable. Like if you are presented with like five decisions to make and you just choose randomly, and you know, they all turn out to be good, you remember actually being more informed. It's called the hindsight bias. You think, oh, well, I knew what I was doing there because I'm smart. And well, you know, you wouldn't. You'd just guess in randomly. But you know, the brain always interprets things in ways which look better at us, make us feel better about ourselves, and that's impacted in the memory. And it's sort of, when it comes to things like court cases and eyewitness trials, that's really really disturbing, because that shouldn't be the case. So, yeah, so it's a problem for the legal system, if nothing else.
All right, I'm going to another example. I guess it's memory related. Why is it that, using the example of a friend, you might say, oh, it's so nice to meet you, to someone, and that person says, well, we've already met? Or, or is...
I've lost so many friends that way.
or you just, you know, hi, this is Tom, hi, you know, and you, then you chat for a while, and then as you walk away from that that encounter, you forgot Tom's name. Why does that happen so frequently?
Well, that sort of ties into, this is like the, based on the evidence I've got, that sort of ties into the whole short-term memory thing, yeah. Because, like I said, short-term memory is very small, so... someone's face is different, because someone's face is like a visual thing. It's very informative and very often very unique to the person, unless you're obviously twins or clones, it could happen. And so you meet someone's face, they see their face, and obviously you've got, you know, all this information, the colour of their eyes, the shape of their nose, their hair, their mouth, their ears, like the facial hair or not, and that's a lot of information to absorb, and it's all visual, and there's parts of the brain which seem to be dedicated to recognising and processing faces. Because that's how humans sort of recognize each other, so it's a sort of an evolved mechanism. Whereas someone's name isn't quite so helpful. So like I said, you'd say the name Tom. So if someone says, no, my name's Tom, that doesn't tell you anything apart from that's their name. There's no way to sort of associate that with that person. And you know the name Tom already. But when someone, you know, when you meet someone for the first time, odds are they don't just tell you their name. They just say, hello, I'm Tom, and just stare at you for like 30 seconds, because that's weird. You know, social norms don't allow that. So they say, well, I'm Tom, I'm here with this person, I know them by that, this is what I do, how are you, what do you do? There's lots of information to take in. And a lot of time, that means the name, the original name, is sort of pushed out in the sort of flow of information that comes from them. And, you know, as a result, you end up remembering a lot about them. You remember, like, oh, they work at that place, they're going out with that person, they live in this particular location. But what's their name? It's just blank, because that was the first thing they told you, and it was the first thing they had booted out again because of all the information that's coming in. The one way around that is to repeat someone's name sort of several times until you can remember it for certain. But as you know, I think I point out that if you someone says to you, hello, my name's Tom, and you just stare at them and say, Tom, 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 for 30 seconds, there's no point remembering the name, because they won't ever speak to you again, because that's weird, and they'll probably be quite scared.
I should point out, I meant to point out that you are... you're a comedy writer, and you do stand-up comedy as well as being a neuroscientist. That's an interesting mix of profession and hobby.
Yes, that's what my parents said. It's sort of a weird thing. I come from a very the Burnett family are quite enthusiastic performers. Should we say they are quite, you know, the sort of family who's always sings on karaoke despite everyone's best requests, and so like there's sort of a lot of clowns, a lot of caperers, and just something I fell into, it's something I got really interested in, and you know, based on some of the results I got in my PhD work, I think a career as a serious academic was never going to happen, so I thought I might as well embrace both sides of it. And yeah, it's a hobby. It's you know, it's not something I get a lot of money for or any, but. Been doing it for over 10 years now, so it's just a, you know, an interesting sideline.
Yeah, and the book is written in a very humorous way. That was intentional, to write about neuroscience and our brains in a comical way?
Yeah, definitely intentional. That sort of came from the Guardian work that I do. That was like sort of the whole point of that, to try and write humorous takes on scientific stories or incorporate science into topical stories in humorous ways. I think it's more to do just almost an experiment on their part to see if it could be done, and so far so good. It's working out okay, and I think there is an audience for it. Based on, it's not just me; like other people have started doing it in the interim. But also, from a neuroscientific perspective, people tend to relate a lot more to things which have an association with a positive sensation. So, you know, you could sit there and reel off fact after fact after fact about the brain and things like that, and they'd all be completely correct, and people might find them interesting, but it's going to be hard to take all that in. Whereas if you sort of add something like, you know, a joke or something which makes people laugh or smile, they'll be far more likely to remember that, because that has a strong emotional component too, and that sort of makes learning a bit easier in that respect. So it was a double-edged thing of, you know, it's something, this is how I write, this is what I do, but also it could potentially be a useful way of going about it.
We are talking with Dean Burnett, a neuroscientist. He is also a writer for The Guardian in a regular column titled Brain Flapping, and he is author of the book Idiot Brain, What Your Head Is Really Up To. And we are talking about how our brain and why our brain does the things it does. We will talk more about memory. We can talk about fears. We can talk about personality, intelligence. Welcome your questions, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about how our brains work and why our brains fail us from time to time. Learn more about memory, personality, intelligence, fear, and much more. And we welcome your questions about the science of our brain and examples maybe of how your brain has let you down. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Dean Burnett. He is the author of Idiot Brain, What Your Head Is Really Up To. And before we take calls, Dean, I wanted to ask you about generally why our brain is doing this. It seems like it's making mistakes and failing us, but I read that in a way you're saying that in some cases our brain is trying to protect us?
It a lot of the stuff it does sort of stems from, well, what seems to be an underlying, let's go with paranoia, I suppose. It has, bear in mind, like we've had, you know, we're part of a species that goes back millions of years and not from various different evolutionary lines. So the first thing the brain had to do, very, very dawn of time, was keep us alive. So that's the thing it's for, really, is to, you know, control the body and do everything that it needs to do to stop us from just randomly dying. And part of that sort of stems from the fact that we actually have a sort of threat detection system, in that at the very lower levels of the brain, very deep sort of primeval levels, there are areas and networks which monitor sort of our incoming sensory information and sort of tag anything which could feasibly be seen as a threat or to present a danger. And it sort of reacts accordingly. So that's why, say, if you're out in the woods just walking and you hear a snap in the distance, it could be just a twig, but you still have that sort of a sort of jump response, because, you know, that's something unfamiliar, you weren't expecting it, it's the part of your brain just triggered off that, oh, just in case that might be dangerous, just react accordingly. And a lot of the time, like, these things haven't gone away. We live in a much safer world now. Of course, we've taken most of the dangers out of our environment. You don't open the kitchen cupboard and there's a wolf in there, that's very rare. And, you know, that's sort of, but still, those parts of the brain which do that haven't gone anywhere, they're still around. And so they sort of scan for dangers and threats in our more modern, sophisticated world, and it sort of recognizes dangers where there aren't any. Things like, you know, like social situations or just like really weird paranoias and phobias. These are manifested by an overactive part of the brain which looks for dangers and is far too fundamental to be told no. So yeah, a lot of the time, that sort of is where a lot of our, you know, eccentricities can stem from.
Yeah, we, of all things, we had a show about phobias just the other day, in part because there are these clown sightings happening in in and around the U.S. And we, right here in Green Bay, Wisconsin, there was a clown walking around with black balloons scaring people. And we talked about why some people truly are afraid of clowns and other, you know, common and odd things. You can tell us why some people have a fear of cheese.
Well, specifically the fear of cheese is a weird one. Obviously, Wisconsin very very famous for its cheese,
right.
Of course, so that's very relevant. Yeah, and it depends where it stems from. Like a lot of phobias, let's say, no matter what they are, they can be learned. So, like, say if your parents have them, that's quite a prominent source. So you're a small child, you're growing up, and you're absorbing everything from the world around you, and you've figured out how things work. And you keep seeing your parents recoil in horror at something, that's your main source of information. You're going to think, okay, well, my parents are the ones who control my entire world, or jumping at shadows and being afraid of cheese. So I guess cheese must be dangerous. You know, that's the sort of subconscious part of the brain is processing that. And so that'll give you a phobia there. But then, you know, anything like you can hear about cheese, like how it's made, it's an odd process. You know, it's milk which comes from a whole other animal, which is, you know, some people find that a bit odd to think about it in any way, and lots of mold and bacteria involved in the process. And these are things which we are told are quite bad. We are told that, bacteria should be avoided. Mold is bad, clean, all that. And to find out it's in a food that you're supposed to eat, then that's, you know, people can make the connection between that's not good, let's avoid that.
I think people with that fear probably, you know, their brains are kind of smart, actually.
It's quite a clever leap to make, you know, but also it could just be a fact that they ate some cheese once and it wasn't very pleasant, obviously not from Wisconsin, somewhere worse. And it was, you know, it made them sick or something, or made them recoil, and anything to do with disgust, the brain is very, very quick to learn that association, because disgust means potentially poison. It makes us sick, makes us ill. So it's very, very quick to, and sort of like, that's bad. You know, never eat that again, that's bad. And then you think about it, and then it sort of makes you feel a bit sick in, you know, in response, and you build up in your head, and it sort of, you plan it, and you sort of think about meeting it again, and then it sort of builds up, and you end up with an irrational phobia or something, and, you know, all due to the fact that the brain is trying to protect us a lot of the time.
Yeah. That just brought up another question before we go to calls. I just talked about our brains being smart. I mean, how do we determine how smart a brain is, and why are some brains smarter than others?
That is obviously a very good question. I mean, intelligence is one of those things that's really hard to measure objectively. So someone's weight or someone's strength, you can test these, and these are physical things. You can, you know, how much can they lift, and what does the scale say? And it's all to do with gravity and forces. So you can measure someone's strength. For someone's intelligence, it's kind of hard to pin down, because people differ on what is intelligence, what is it? You know, people, if you ask 10 people what is intelligence, you'll get 10 different answers probably, along a similar theme, but in a scientific sense, it's a lot harder to pin it down. So you have things like IQ tests, but IQ is more of a relative measure of, you know, how smart are you compared to everyone else who's done this test. But then this test is based on previous tests, which is, you know, measured on other people. And so it goes back in a sort of very complex way. But on a neurological level, like down in the gray matter, actually, and it's more to do with sort of gray and white matter. The white matter is the connections between various parts of the brain. And they try to put, like, I think I mentioned it in the book a lot, that there's, you know, a test where they put people in a brain scanner and to show which parts were active when they were doing an intelligence test. And the more, you know, the better someone was at the test, the more these certain areas lit up. So, you know, that's the part of the brain which is for intelligence. But then after a certain point, when people kept getting better and better at the test, those areas would sort of not be as active anymore. So they would say, well, how does that work? Is it only, that's only for intelligence and people up to a certain point? But the theory now is that it's not to do with, you know, which part is more active. It's how efficient the brain is, that how well connected all these different parts are. Because you need so many different parts of the brain to be able to operate things intelligently, you know, be able to focus and think fast and deduct things and plan things and remember things. These are all various different areas involved. And the better the connections, the more intelligent someone tends to be. And that doesn't show up as, you know, like increased activity. It's just efficiency. I think the example I use is you have two cars going, driving along side by side at like 70 miles an hour. One car's making a roaring noise, going, you know, one car's almost silent. The silent car is the better car, even though they're doing the same thing, because that's far more efficient, far more smooth, far more well-organized. And that sort of seems to be how intelligence operates at down at the cellular level.
All right, to our callers, Chris in Eau Claire is with us first. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Hey, Chris.
Yes, I'm left-handed, and mostly ambidextrous, bat right-handed, brush my teeth left-handed, basically everything else right-handed. I was wondering if the two sides of the brain, being left and right-handed, might confuse things. I have trouble with remembering names and processes and things of that nature, so I was just wondering if that had anything to do with it.
Potentially, yes, there could well be something to do with that, in that, obviously, most people have a dominant hemisphere. Now, the people who don't know the brain has two hemispheres. One is dominant, the other is slightly less powerful. And the dominant side influences which hand we use, like that side of our body, or the other side, actually, it crosses over. That side of our body is the one which we lead with. And you know, there's a lot of sort of claims going around that so one side, like the right side, is artistic and the left side is analytical, or vice versa. And that's sort of massive oversimplification of how the brain actually works. There does seem to be some minor differences between the two hemispheres, but not to that extent. You know, you can't put up a Facebook test and find out. That's not how it works. But yeah, if you've got like the bridge between the two, the corpus callosum, that's quite a big tract of white matter, and that could potentially be that's quite, you know, it's quite well evolved in you, or it's quite dense, and as a result, you've got two sides of the brain which are competing perhaps equally. And yeah, like one side of the brain normally takes charge, and the other one is, you know, perhaps more supportive role or more redundancy there. So if there is much excessive and anomalous communication between the two hemispheres, then that could feasibly sort of cause confusion, like you say. So you have two sides trying to do the same job. You've probably had that in, you know, people have had that in work, like when two people are assigned to the same task, it makes it more chaotic, not less, you know, it makes it a lot more laborious. So yeah, there could be that. Also, it's just, it could be something else entirely. Like, you know, if you're bad with names, that's quite a normal thing to be. It's just something which some people just have a bit of trouble with. It's just luck of the draw sometimes, how your brain develops and expresses itself as you grow.
Thank you, Chris. So what's going on with the brain that causes someone to be right-handed versus left-handed?
To say exactly what causes that is an odd, so there's a lot of research gone into it, but it happens because one side is sort of dominant. The brain has, you know, both hemispheres have, you know, the same bits, essentially. They both have a hippocampus, both have a prefrontal cortex, both have a parietal lobes, visual cortex, and they communicate and cooperate, but one side tends to take the lead, as it were. Exactly why that is, it's more of a lot of stuff like this, like basically why does the brain have two hemispheres like that to begin with? Like, well, what's the point of that? And you have to remember, in evolutionary terms, there's no actual point to it. It was just, this is how it's evolved. It hasn't failed yet. It still works.
Yeah.
And that's a system that actually just it's worked. There's no reason to drop it. It's not gone for the best solution. It's gone for whatever works. And it's come up with this system, and that's what we've got. So, yeah, it's more a case of why are people left-handed? Why not? I guess is the answer, really, in terms of neuroscience.
Barry in Madison is with us. Hi, Barry.
Yeah, hi. I have two questions. What causes abnormal sexual impulses? And my second question is, what causes paper hoarding in the mind and the brain?
Oh, two very different things, I think.
Yes, but, brilliant. Abnormal sexual impulses, that's the brain, you know, deals with sex in very different, sort of very complex ways. It's very, it occurs at many levels. There's the basic, obviously, primitive urge to reproduce. There's also the societal urge that you want to be sexually active is sort of seen as a socially, a social achievement. And there's things which we make associations. Like if you are already sort of, the part of your brain which controls sexual urges can just be slightly overactive, or you can have a slightly higher level of hormone like in your system. A lot of time it's just down to just random chance sometimes, or just how you develop, a certain gene or a certain vitamin even has been excessive or repressed. But then you actually sort of make connections. And if you talk about abnormal associations with things, like that, if you experience sexual stimulation in a weird context, then the brain will sort of make that link. They actually did this in a very old scientific experiment. I'm not sure you get away with it now, whereby they sort of gave a lot of male volunteers a boot, sort of a high-heeled boot, to sort of just interact with, just hold it, just, play with it, essentially. and then showed them sort of hardcore pornography at the same time. And so at the end of it, a lot of the subjects had what would be considered a shoe fetish, because they made the link between, okay, so whenever I see a shoe, I get sexual stimulation. And that's something with sort of, you know, just luck of the draw sometimes. You can be in certain contexts and situations, and it's so powerful, it's so visceral, the sensation, that the brain very quickly makes these links.
And before you get to paper recording, I this is another current issue in the news. What I was thinking about in part when Barry asked that question is, why would somebody who is seemingly very successful and intelligent and powerful as Senator Chuck Schumer, who got caught not once but twice but three times sending you know, inappropriate photos of himself via text to somebody. Why would the brain allow someone to do that?
It's, again, it comes down to the whole sexual thing. It's such a powerful and visceral sensation. The brain sort of prioritizes that over a lot of other things. Like, you know, same thing happens with drug addiction. Like, if you do something often enough and the brain recognizes, oh, that causes pleasure, that causes very positive feeling, it does tend to mess up our motivations and our sense of priorities. So if you are, you know, very, very powerful and very secure in your work, in your life, in your position, but then doing that is, you know, it's also a new thing too. It's very, like, very much like, oh, I can get away with this. I am too powerful. I can, you know, find myself a new sexual partner by doing this sort of thing. And that's, you know, you get a certain thrill from it. You get a certain drive from it. Perhaps because you are so secure and so, you know, so so safe in your position. That's sort of something which the brain always looks for novelty. And there's other things too. So, yeah, it's just the thrill of it, the, you know, the fact that it derives sexual pleasure from it, and that tends to override a lot of logic a lot of the time.
And people, I think, can understand why you might, you know, I don't know, collect little statues, but why would people hoard newspapers and magazines to the point that they can't even walk in their house?
Yeah, hoarding behavior is a strange one. There's, I think even John Ronson mentioned it once. There's a strange sort of moral sense to it, too. First off, the brain doesn't like anything which causes it to lose control. Basically, the brain's all about control, and anything which causes it to lose that can be very stressful. That's like when you're in traffic, for example, and you know, you're stuck in traffic, you can't do anything about it, you get really frustrated, you get really tense, you get really upset about it, and you end up taking up something else. And the hoarding behavior can sometimes be a manifestation of that if it goes a bit too far. As in, I can't just throw these things out because that is, you know, that's beyond my control. I don't know what's happening to them. I am effectively, you know, there's a strong moral sense to it too. Like, it's like I can't pollute the world. Like, you hear, you know, perhaps you hear about the environment on the news, or you see fly tipping and all these, you know, the waste landfills and things, and those things upset you. And you think, well, if I, you know, if I throw these out, I'm just making the problem worse. So I'll just keep them here. And that gives you a sense of control back in there. See, I've kept it now. I've solved the problem. But of course, you keep getting papers and keep getting things in your house, and then that problem doesn't go away. So you still, they rack up, they stack up, and they sort of build up more and more. And the sense of control you get from it, the sense of sort of achievement, the sense of well-being. And people don't like throwing things out sometimes. You know, these are my things. If I lose these things, I will be lesser. I will have lost something, and that
yes.
And sometimes it, you know, it can go a bit too far and things like that too. So there's lots of contributions to it.
I have to correct myself. I made a mistake that actually is related to our discussion in trying to grasp the name of the politician who was sexting. I said the wrong politician's name. The right politician's name is Anthony Weiner. It is not Chuck Schumer. So I deeply apologize for that. But what's going on there? Why did my brain fail me there?
I'll be honest, I don't know Chuck Schumer, so I can't comment on his history either. So that's something I'm going to point out there right now. But if, you know, if it's something you've thought of recently, like it's maybe at the forefront of your mind, or you've been involved in a vaguely similar thing, then the brain's assembling memories, essentially. If there's an overlap between the two, or if they just look similar, the brain will sort of think, like, I need to, you know, who is that person who did that? And it'll come up with an answer. And sometimes, like, it'll be the wrong answer. And then something called blocking occurs, whereby you say the name, and you think, no, not them, and then you can't think of the second one, because, you know, the part of your brain which does retrieval has said, no, that's the right one, that's the right one, and then you sort of can't stop thinking about that. It keeps repeating itself, and the actual real memory is blocked. And as a result, it sort of becomes very frustrating. This happens a lot in quizzes, you know, in trivia things, when, say, so who was the actor who played XYZ in that film. And then you remember, oh no, not that one, but you remember someone who looks like that, and then you can't think of anything else, and it gets really, really annoying. So like it's all like there's a logjam in the memory retrieval system.
Well, I'm glad that actually a listener caught that, and I was able to make the correction. So we are talking about brain science and why our brains do the things they do and why our brains seemingly screw up now and again, like I just did. Our guest is the author of Idiot Brain, What Your Head Is Really Up To. We welcome your questions, your examples, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Dean Burnett. He is a neuroscientist, a lecturer for Cardiff University in the Center for Medical Education. He's a writer for The Guardian, a regular section titled Brain Flapping, and he is the author of the book Idiot Brain, What Your Head Is Really Up To. And we welcome your questions about brain science, and maybe it's about memory or fear or intelligence or personality or other issues involving our brains. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let's go to Bill in Superior next. Hi, Bill.
Hello. I had a question. When I was young, I was in a mental hospital down in Madison, and my dad took me down there on a train, and we stayed in a hotel till the next day to go to the hospital. But I had shock treatments, and I can't remember that at all, and that got wiped out years ago after I had those treatments. And I was wondering if the shock treatments did something to that memory.
Well, first of all, I don't know, Dean Burnett, if you can just tell us what this shock treatment, electrical shock treatment, is and what it hopes to do and what it does do, and does it destroy memory?
Shock treatment, it would be electroconvulsive therapy. That's it's got a very bad reputation because of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Yeah. So that's the treatment they use on him. So it just almost completely wipe his mind, essentially. It isn't, it's nowhere near as graphic and bad as that. It's basically that film did for electroshock therapy what Jaws did for sharks, really, sort of made them a lot scarier than they actually are. But it is still quite an intense therapy. It's not used lightly. But it is, so it sort of sends powerful electrical impulses through the brain to, it's one of a better description. It's to try and reset things, like trying to sort of cause activity in parts which aren't working, and try to, just like how you sort of shock, a heart when they when they've gone into cardiac arrest, and try and get the rhythms back into place. Then that's sort of a vaguely similar approach to electroconvulsive therapy, although it's a lot more complex because obviously the brain doesn't work like the heart like that. It's far more complex in what it does. But yes, I think that's very common to have disrupted memory after electroconvulsive therapy. It's like I have friends who have gone through this and expressed very similar problems or very similar lack of memories of the events surrounding them. In that when the memory is formed, like when you have recent memories, they are located by sort of the hippocampus in the brain, and the older the memory is, the further and further out, it's sort of pushed further out into the brain as more memories are laid down behind it, sort of like something on a conveyor belt. So the older memories tend to be a lot more spread out, and the newer memories are a lot more vulnerable because they're not as established yet, they're not as shown up, they're not as well laid down. And that tends to be, they tend to be around the areas which are sort of stimulated by electroconvulsive therapy. So, yeah, that's actually very, very common to have a memory problem resulting from electroconvulsive therapy. I mean, it tends to, maybe not 100% back to normal, but time and recovery tends to happen. But memories that are laid down or acquired around the time of the event, they tend to be badly disrupted, yes. So that's entirely entirely normal with this sort of thing.
Yeah. Thank you, Bill, for the call. Dan on Facebook says, in the long days of summer, I am chronically sleep-deprived for weeks. How does sleep deprivation impair our brains?
Yeah, sleep's a weird one because, like I think I mentioned, I did mention this book, actually, we're not exactly sure what sleep is for yet, exactly in a scientific sense. Like most people say it's for rest and recovery. But I think, as I point out, you can spend all day like a lumberjack chopping wood, like just being outdoors doing something very physical, very intense. And you go to bed that night, you sleep for 8 hours, if that's your usual amount of sleeping time. You got the day off the next day, you can just, sit around watching TV. You go to bed, you still sleep for 8 hours. So it's not just about how much recovery and rest you need. It's clearly more to it than that. But, yeah, sleep deprivation is very, very damaging. And in extreme cases, it can be quite debilitating. In the short term, it's just annoying. It makes you groggy. It makes you lethargic. Because whatever sleep is for, the brain definitely needs it. That's how much we do know. And even hibernated animals need to sleep, which sounds counterintuitive. But when something's hibernated, it's more like it's in a coma. But the brain is far more active when it's asleep. So the animal has to actually wake up a bit in order to sleep, which sounds ridiculous, I know, but that's sort of how nature works sometimes. And, yeah, so like in summertime, like a lot of our circadian rhythms, like the rhythms that set how much we sleep, they're influenced by daylight. Like the eyes pick up daylight and certain hormone in the brain, melatonin, is released or stopped in response. And the more daylight you experience, the less the hormones in your system and the less tired you are. So, yeah, but after a while, the brain does sort of go a little bit off kilter without enough sleep, and you start doing things like micro-sleep, where you can be in the middle of a task and you'll sleep for like 10 seconds and wake up again. But that's very much a stopgap solution. You can't survive on that long term. And a lot of sort of disasters in the past have been sort of implicated due to people being overworked and lack of sleep and just not having their eye on the ball with things like that. So if you can get some sleep, and I very much advise it because it's kind of important.
Yeah, so why do we, when we do get our sleep, experience dreams or even nightmares?
Again, that's another sort of opinions on the matter vary, but the most consistent theory I can find is that one of the things the brain does when we're asleep, especially in REM sleep, so the very deepest part of sleep where we dream, that's when it's sort of refining and filtering the memory system. So taking old memories, new memories, making the new ones a bit more secure, activating the old ones to sort of dust them off, essentially, for want of a better description. And it does this with no real pattern or no real order. So there are, you can dream about something which happened to you that day, and then that involves something from your childhood, then something from last year, then something from something from the previous year, then something from your teenage years, and these all melded together in one weird scenario, because there's no actual pattern or logic to them. They're just all memories being activated at random times. But the frontal cortex, the part of your brain which is sort of like the conscious driving seat, is trying to impose some sort of narrative on this, trying to make sense of what's going on. So you have this weird scenario where you're dreaming something ridiculous, but it seems normal to you. And that's where you got this weird thing. But a lot of memories also have a strong emotional component. Sometimes it's fear, and sometimes it's, especially if you're very anxious about something, very, very, preoccupied by thinking about something, that's gonna feature a lot of your memories. And as a result, you'll sort of dream about it more to the point where you have nightmares about it. So when the memory is activated, all the elements of it can be activated too, and especially if it's something that scared you. So you have this really weird scenario where you have a very strong memory for something which scares you, being sort of fixed a bit during the dream sequence, and you end up with nightmares. So you have these weird, unpleasant scenarios that your brain keeps playing for you. So it's constantly busy, the brain, but it's also, that means we experience weird things sometimes.
Neil in Slinger is with us now. Hi, Neil.
Hi. It seems as if my brain works in my sleep, and I think others do. If I have a problem, instead of a mechanical, usually, instead of beating my head against the wall, I sleep on it. The next day, the answer is there.
Hmm. Yeah, that's perfectly sort of consistent in that. Like I said, that when you're asleep, like your brain's sort of fixing the memory system a bit, especially if you've got a problem in front of you and you don't know the exact solution. Then you start thinking of all the different various solution scenarios. Like, can I try this? I'll try that. That hasn't worked. This hasn't worked. And you sort of end up being stressed about it, which confuses you a bit more. So you try something else. So the stepping back a bit and then sort of sleeping on it, especially, so give your brain a chance to you know, embed all the different outcomes, different scenarios, different plans you had. And you know, just approaching something with fresh eyes can be far more helpful like that. Even if it's just a matter of sleep, sort of refreshing your brain to the point where you can think a bit more laterally about it, think a bit more logically, a bit more calmly, that'll normally be enough to offer a solution. But yeah, so you know, just sleeping on a problem is generally good advice, unless, of course, it's a very urgent problem, in which case it's bad advice. But you know, either way, it can help sometimes.
Yeah. So speaking of nightmares, which I'm happy to report I don't have very often, why do some people, with Halloween coming up, might be enjoying horror movies or you know, going into haunted houses? Why do some people want to be frightened?
It doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? Especially things like, you know, enjoying horror movies. Like, that's a very, very popular genre, horror. And even now, like, things like Saw, the gore, the torture aspect of it is very, very popular, very mainstream. But, you know, you'd think that would be something that puts people off. I don't like it at all, personally. It's a possibility that it's to do with, like, the brain has a sort of a reward system, right, in the very center, the mesolimbic pathway, which every time the brain experiences something which it likes or which it thinks is good, it lets us have this sensation of reward. So an example being, if you were really thirsty, you drink some water, and normally that would be boring, but when you're really thirsty, it's really nice. So yeah, that pleasure, that feeling, that's reward. So your brain's going, good, you were thirsty, you drank something, do that some more. And you know, if you eat something pleasant, or like, you know, sexual experiences all have this as well. But then something which also the brain approves of is things you do to stop yourself, you know, get out of danger. So if you're experiencing, you know, especially imagine if you're in the wild, you're being chased by a tiger or something, and you escape, you know, you get that giddy thrill of, oh my goodness, I just, you know, I could have been killed then. You got that sort of weird high that you get from surviving a sort of terrifying scenario. And horror and things like that could be sort of providing a very sort of low-level blast of that, in that you are, so if you're watching a horror movie, you're sat in the cinema or something, then you've got, you know, the atmosphere is really tense and it's really scary, and you see all this blood and gore, and that's quite, you know, it's quite scary. And you're obviously very stimulated, very high on the fear hormones, the fear system. And then it's finished, and then, you know, at the end of it, you are fine. Obviously, there's nothing wrong with you at all. So the brain sort of thinks, well, you were just really scared of something a second ago, but now you're not. So whatever you did was good. So yeah, have some reward. You know, have a good feeling.
Dean, we have just a minute to go. Last question. What should we remember about our brains, maybe to make our lives a little easier?
That they are flawed, and it's not your fault. That's essentially the take-home message from all that.
Thank you very much for being with us. Dean Burnett is a neuroscientist and lecturer for Cardiff University in the Center for Medical Education. He's a writer for The Guardian. His column is Brain Flapping. He's also author of the book Idiot Brain, What Your Head Is Really Up To. And we thank him for being with us, and we thank you for joining in. We thank producers Kai Brito, Brianne Chasso, and Naisha Ellison. Coming up tomorrow at this time, it's the Week in Review. Our guests will discuss and debate the top stories in state and national politics. That's the Week in Review, every Friday from 8 until 9. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.